Did you know we have completely ad-free early access to all of our episodes? Well, we do. Not only that, but we have dozens of bonus episodes waiting for you. Head on over to patreon.com/ghosttownpod, and you can check it out for 7 days absolutely free. That's patreon.com/ghosttownpod.
As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
A deadly case of cabin fever. I'm Jason Horton.
I'm Rebecca Lieb.
And this is Ghost Town.
The Keddie Cabin Murders from April 1981. Three people, including a single mother of five, Glenna Sue Sharp, her son John, and a family friend, Dana Wingate, were tied up, bludgeoned, and stabbed to death inside a tiny cabin in this resort-like community in Plumas County. Her 12-year-old daughter, Tina, was taken from the cabin.
I went camping with my dad in the Sierra Nevadas in Northern California about 4 years ago, I would say. And that was scary enough. Like, that was enough. My dad almost died on the trip. I remember having to be like, will the jaws of life come down into this gully to pick up my very dehydrated dad if need be? So I was thinking about what something we could do there, something cabin-like. We don't often traverse like more like spooky camp stories, which are almost one of the scariest things to me, really, because you have nothing. You're just on your own out there. And I was also thinking about what we talked about last week, which is unsolved mysteries and murders and cold cases and how there's a lot of technology that can help us solve things way after the fact. So this has it all, baby. This has it all. Today we're going to talk about the Keddie murders, or the gruesome quadruple homicide that happened in Cabin 28. Ooh.
Homicide?
Homicide. Did I say homicide?
Yeah.
Oh, I also have a cold. I'll blame it on the cold.
Yeah. No, you're, yeah. I'm done being sick, and now you're almost done being sick.
I'm almost done being sick. So I apologize if I sound sexy as hell during this podcast. This happened in 1981 in Keddie, a rural resort town in the Sierra Nevadas in Northern California. And it is pretty gruesome and puzzling to all. But
I mean, as soon as you said it was 1981, I was like, there's no one knows what's going on here.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. What's happening? Everyone's in faded baseball shirts and cutoffs. A lot of bowl cuts happening.
Pac-Man fever is running wild.
Exactly. We've got Keds. Right? Keds were big then? Yeah, Keds. We got Pepsis. We got Pizza Huts. Rampant.
Atari 2600.
That's right. That's right. That's good. But I want to show you guys. I mean, first, before you listen to this, if you can, to see the cabin that this all takes place in, it is like an 80s B movie, like a horror movie. It fits the part completely. There was a movie roughly based on what we're about to talk about, but it is like it sets the scene for everything. Very rural, very bare bones, rickety old cabin.
White Chicks?
Mm-hmm.
It's not the movie White Chicks, is it?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, it's the movie White Chicks. Sorry. Forget the Keddie murders. You're right. Unzip White Chicks.
Okay.
Anyway, in the fall of 1980, Glenna Susan Sue Sharp and her five children left her home in Connecticut after separating from her husband, James Sharp. Connecticut also is a horrifying place. We're going from like one horrifying place on the East Coast. Yeah.
There's something like a haunting in Connecticut. I feel like Connecticut's have, isn't there a movie or something that's a haunting in Connecticut? Or feel like
Connecticut's just full of woods and white collar criminals. It's absolutely horrifying. So she decided to relocate to Northern California where her brother Don was living because she was separating from her husband, building a new life with her five children since birth. Upon arriving in California, she rented Cabin 28 at the Keddie Resort in rural Sierra Nevada in Keddie. There, she resided with her 15-year-old son, John, 14-year-old daughter, Sheila, 12-year-old daughter, Tina, and two younger sons, Rick and Greg. Rick was 10, Greg was age 5. So we have a range of kids. So we have Sue, Again, to review, John, 14, Sheila, 12, Tina, Rick, and Greg. On April 11, 1981, around 1:30 p.m., Sue and Sheila drove from Keddy to pick up John and his friend Dana Hall Wingate from Gassner Park in Quincy, California, and brought them to Keddy, 5 miles-ish away. 2 hours later, about 3:30 p.m., John and Dana hitchhiked back to Quincy. Again, it was the 80s, where they were supposed to visit some friends. Around this time, the two were seen in the city's downtown area. A local woman, Donna Williams, claimed to have picked them up in front of a tire store and given them a ride down the road to another friend's home. Then later, the two were seen at a party at Oakland Camp in Quincy. That same evening, Sheila had plans to spend the night with the Seabolt family who lived in the next cabin, while Sue remained at home with Rick, Greg, and the boy's young friend, Justin Smart. Sheila left the cabin shortly after 8 p.m., leaving her mother alone with younger children. Tina, who had been watching television at the Seabolts, returned home to the cabin around 9:30 p.m. after Sheila arrived to spend the night. So there's a lot of things happening. We've got people coming in and out. There's a lot of children. It'll get a little bit clearer. Around 7 a.m. in the morning of April 12th, Sheila returned home and discovered the dead bodies of Sue, John, and Dana in the cabin's living room. All three had been bound with adhesive tape and wire. Tina was gone, while the three younger children, Rick, Greg, and Justin, were just completely unharmed in the next bedroom. Initial reports stated that the three young boys had slept through the incident, though this was kind of contradicted later. Upon discovering the scene, Sheila rushed back to the Seabolt's cabin, grabbed James Seabolt, who grabbed Rick, Greg, and Justin through the bedroom window. He later admitted to having briefly entered the cabin through the back door to see if anyone was still alive, which completely contaminated everything in the process. And also, that didn't come out till later, too. Weird admission after the fact. The murders of Sue, John, and Dana were horrible. Two bloodied knives and one hammer were found at the scene, and one of the knives, a steak knife later determined to have been used in the murders, had been bent in half due to extreme force. So when we talk about the Burger Chef murders, we talked again about another horrible knife injury where you can imagine the force that was used to have these murders happen. Blood spatter evidence from inside the house indicated that the murders of Sue, John, and Dana had all taken place in the living room. Sue was discovered lying on her side near the living room sofa, nude from the waist down and gagged with a blue bandana and her own panties, which had been secured with tape. She had been stabbed in the chest. Her throat was slashed, and on the side of her head was an imprint matching the butt of a Daisy 880 BB gun. John's throat was slashed. Dana had multiple head injuries and had been manually strangled. All three had blunt force trauma to their heads caused by hammer or hammers. Autopsies determined that they died from the knife wounds and blunt force trauma. Not a great way to go. Not a great way to go. And these, again, are very healthy young teenagers. Sheila and the Seabolt family, with whom Sheila had spent the night in the neighboring cabin, heard nothing during the night. A couple living nearby were awakened around 1:30 a.m. with what sounded like muffled screaming, but they couldn't really say where from. Tina's jacket, shoes, and a shoebox containing various tools were missing from the cabin, which showed no indication of forced entry. An unidentified fingerprint was found on a handrail on the stairs leading to the cabin's back door. The cabin's telephone had been left off the hook, the lights in the cabin were completely off, and the drapes were closed. Suspects interviewed included a man who disappeared from Keddy shortly after the murders and was later found in Oregon. After submitting to a polygraph examination, the suspect was cleared. One of the Sharps' neighbors, Marilyn Smart, the mother of Justin Smart, later claimed that she had found a bloody jacket belonging to Tina in her basement and had turned it into the police, though no official record of that has ever existed. Her husband, Martin Smart, also claimed that a claw hammer had been inexplicably gone missing from his home. Plumas County Sheriff Doug Thomas, who presided over the case, later stated that Martin had provided endless clues in the case that seemed to throw the suspicion away from him. Loaded statement. In addition to interviewing the Smarts, detectives interviewed numerous other locals and the neighbors. Several, including members of the Seabolt family, recalled seeing an unknown green van parked at the Sharps' cabin around 9 p.m. Others recalled noticing a brown Datsun parked at the residence that evening, which appeared to have a tire that was going flat. Justin gave conflicting stories of the evening, including that he had dreamt details of the murders, though later claimed to have actually witnessed them. In his latter account of events, told under hypnosis, he claimed to have heard sounds coming from the living room while watching television in the bedroom with Rick and Greg. Can you imagine? Like, if that is true, to, like, be processing something in another room that is horrifying and just not having left?
what I can't help but think, and I don't know if anyone listening is thinking the same thing. What sounds like the most obvious thing?
Yeah, that they murdered them, right? It's hard to. But why?
I mean, why doesn't matter. It's the what, Occam's razor? I mean, that would say that.
There's not like a history of violence really that I found with, you know.
You don't know.
It's true. Yeah. I don't know. They could have been the internet
chopping up animals, you know.
Very true. So investigating these sounds, Rick and Greg went to investigate. He saw Sue and two men, one with a mustache and long hair, the other clean shaven with short hair. Both wore glasses. According to Justin, John and Dana then entered the home and began heatedly arguing with the men. There was a fight. Tina entered the room and then she was taken out of the cabin's back door by one of the men. Based on Justin's descriptions, composite sketches of the two unknown men were produced by forensic artist Harlan Embry. In press releases accompanying the sketches, the suspects were described as being in their late 20s, early 30s. One was around 5'11", the other was 6'2", tall with dark blonde hair. And then the other one was a little bit shorter, 5'3", with black greased hair, and then 5'10". Both had gold frame glasses. Rumors regarding the crimes became like ritualistic or motivated by drug trafficking, went on for a while, but then they were kind of dismissed by the county sheriff, who said that they didn't find any drug paraphernalia. They didn't find any like weird ritualistic thing. A lot of the times there's a lot of symbiology involved in that. Nothing of the sort in this case. Carla McMullen, a family acquaintance, later told detectives that Dana Wingate had recently stolen an unknown quantity of LSD from local drug dealers, though she was unable to provide proof of this claim. So again, it's like, could this, something like that, for example, LSD, which would maybe put it into a different realm of murder, she could be totally just making it up because she's, you know, swept up in it, or it could be a crucial piece of eyewitness testimony. We don't know. About 4,000 man hours were spent working on the case, which Thomas described as frustrating the sheriff. In December 1983, detectives ruled out serial killers Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Toole as potential suspects. Because Tina was believed to have been abducted from the crime scene, her disappearance was initially investigated by the FBI, though it was reported on April 29th, 1981, that the FBI had backed off the search as the Department of Justice was doing an adequate job and made the FBI's presence unnecessary. A grid pattern search of the area covering a 5-mile radius around the cabin was conducted with police dogs, but they didn't find anything. On April 22nd, 1984, 3 years and 11 days after the murders and Tina's disappearance, a bottle collector discovered a cranium portion of a human skull and part of a mandible at Camp 18 near Feather Falls in the neighboring Butte County, a distance of about 100 miles from Keddie. Shortly after announcing the discovery, Butte County Sheriff's Office received an anonymous call that identified the remains as belonging to Tina, but the call was not documented in this case. A recording of the call was found at the bottom of an evidence box at some point after 2013 by a deputy who was assigned the case. The remains were confirmed by a forensic pathologist to be those of Tina Sharp in June 1984. Near the remains, detectives also found a child's blanket, a blue nylon jacket, a pair of Levi Strauss jeans with a missing back pocket, and an empty surgical tape dispenser. Very sad. Let's take a breather. Let's take a break and we'll get back to it.
Welcome to Scare You to Sleep. Do you love listening to podcasts to fall asleep to, but hate waking up to loud laughter or yelling? Are you also a fan of horror and scary stories? Then this is the podcast for you. Join me, Shelby Scott, as you curl up and relax while I read you a spooky bedtime story and listen to the gentle, yet somewhat unnerving, sounds of all that go bump in the night. Hope to scare you soon.
We have a lot of nice messages.
Yeah,
which is nice.
That is nice.
Some nice reviews, nice messages, which we appreciate. Emily, I say Emily or Emil, but it's Emily Stafford. I stumbled across this podcast a while back. I listened to the podcast very little until the Woodstock 99 episode. Now I'm absolutely hooked because of the story.
Jason hooks him in, baby.
This isn't going to be the first Woodstock 99 mention. Because of this historical aspect of Woodstock and being raised on classic rock and the commentary on the crimes. So I have a couple from YouTube. We have a YouTube channel where we put stuff on.
Just look up Ghost Town. Somebody checks that out.
Just look up Ghost Town Podcast if you want to subscribe to it or give a thumbs up on a video. It helps. Just, you know, trying to spread it around.
Yeah, all media. We're coming on ya.
Is that how it goes?
Yeah, coming on ya. Great. Hi, Mom.
Johnny Rockwell says...
Ooh, Johnny.
About Woodstock 99. Funnily enough, I'm going to assume that's a word.
Yeah.
I know Frostbit Blue. One of the bands. Remember I've read all the bands? Yeah. Who knows Frostbit Blue?
Oh, my God.
One of the members was a teacher at my school. The band is still together, actually. Not, and as you back, I was like, that's kind of great. Like,
I love that. Yeah, I will invite them on behalf of both of us to come say hello
and then
Ghost Town.
Matthias Bonici.
Nice.
Action Park. At the end, Action Park costs $15 for kids between 70 and 28.
Finally, some answers of how much it fucking cost. I have asked everyone. I've elicited so many conversations based on, again, this is Jason's motivated, one of our favorite episodes, Action Park. But we still could not nail down how much it cost per head.
You paid with blood. We went every year. My brother lost a lot of skin on the Alpine slide. The track got so hot it melted his skin when he crashed. As a 12-year-old, this is not another episode.
This is a gift that keeps on giving.
As a 12-year-old, I used to dive to the bottom of the cliff jump pool and collect all the money and jewelry that came up from people who jumped in. What a grift. What a grift. I love it. We also used to stand by the Geronimo Falls and watch the ladies come down the slide without their bathing suits, since it was basically impossible to keep anything tied onto that ride.
Oh,
I'm proud to say
fucking God.
That I'm an Action Park survivor.
Should we have the Action Park Awards every year where people... like send us their most gruesome and vulgar stories,
I mean,
and we judge them.
The fact that it's so hot.
That is, I will never unhear that.
Yeah.
Your skin melting off because of a hot slide.
Yeah. It's so we got some nice messages.
Goodness. Yeah.
Check us out on patreon.com/ghosttownpod.
Yeah.
Bonus episodes, early access with no ads. You don't hear any of this. You miss all of this.
Cut all this out.
Cut it all out.
Mm-hmm. And just get to it. Just get to the good.
I'm going to throw a little something, another true crime thing out there. Okay. And I didn't bring this up yet. I was talking about January Jones, and I was listening to her. She's from Mad Men. She plays Betty Draper.
She's amazing.
I listened to her on Armchair Expert podcast, which I really don't listen to, but I was like, I want to hear about her. She's great. She loves true crime. Also loves Vanderpump Rules, but loves true crime.
Two of our favorite things.
She said, and this might be common knowledge, but about JonBenet Ramsey, she's like, the brother did it.
Yeah.
She ate his pineapple and whatever. He got mad and hit her because he's 9 years old.
And the parents
are
covering it up.
The parents are covering it up.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean,
so
I think I think that's a pretty well-defined and believable theory. I think also, you know, the dad, I mean, it's hard because like the sexual stuff is always kind of in the background too. And I don't think her brother did that, but I do think it was done in the family. Someone in the family committed this crime. And I think, yeah, the brother had anger issues, you know.
But he says like the brother, like he, of course, you know, either he really doesn't remember it, it's blocked out because it's traumatic, or he does and he's like, well, I'm not going to, what do you want me to say now?
Yeah.
I'm a murderer. I mean, I was 9 and she also brought up that you can't try a child for murder until they're 10 and he was 9. So really they went through this whole thing that made it kind of worse, that shined a lot of lights on things instead of saying like, our son just got really mad. He didn't realize what he was doing.
Yeah.
And I don't think people would have been like, well, he should be, you know, be put to death.
It's almost like a season of Fargo where you're like, what are you doing? Just
also,
say the truth. Like,
you're accusing a lot of other people in its wake.
Yeah, there's a lot of other bullshit happening. When really just saying the truth would be an easier, cleaner, and better for everybody scenario.
Yeah,
I think Burke is, I think that's a pretty, like, popular opinion, very logical. I still, you know, I don't think we'll ever get closure on that case, really. At some point, I hope somebody, like, he would probably have to say something, I guess.
Well, I think this case, honestly, it seems like the most obvious thing, and it's not being talked about.
Yeah, but it's, oh God, yeah, I just don't know why. I'm also watching Aaron Hernandez documentary, too. And it's the same thing where it's like, now we're kind of getting to the why, like 6 episodes in. But I was like, I need the why. I need at least a kernel of the why to follow that thing, which I get again with JonBenet Ramsey. It's like the brother like got mad at her. He had anger issues. She was like eating his stuff.
Well, and in fairness, like my like sisters would fight like violently, mm-hmm. where it would be very easy for honestly for that to happen.
Well, really?
Yeah. Pretty bad.
My brother was a biter. Yeah. But I have two brothers and they would fight, but one of them was like a little more violent than the other.
My sisters were very like, tough.
Really?
Kind of, you know, they kind of were like criminal. They're completely not like that at all now. Mm-hmm. You can still see it in their eyes though.
Yeah. There's a little glint of violence.
I don't care if you have a 401k.
Don't cross them.
I know who
don't
you are.
Don't cross the Horton sisters.
Not Horton. Only one Horton.
Okay. Don't cross one Horton sister, one unnamed last name sister. They will. They'll never forget.
Spielberg is another
lesson. Spielberg. This is a nice Jewish girl. Are they still single? I want to set them up with
Steven Spielberg's kids.
A really nice hedge fund.
When my mom was married to Steven Spielberg.
Oh,
did I mention that?
Yeah. Well, you never mentioned Dive, so.
Yeah.
Coming to California because Steven Spielberg's mom had that restaurant, that like burger restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
Based on Jaws. And we would go there because they had this like cage of fries that you'd get them in. It was like submarine themed. Oh. It was like my favorite place in the world for a really long time. Horrible, disgusting food. But Spielberg, you know, what are you supposed to do? Let's get back to our murder at hand, shall we? So that is really what happened until around 1996. And this is the point where we're going to get to all of the updates. And like I said before, a case is never really locked and closed. There are things that happen. There are like insane amount of progress that can be made with the proper technology, with people dying, with people not dying, and enough time going by where they're like, hey, actually, I saw something kind of a thing. And this is one of those cases in point that I was really thinking about after the Burger Chef murders. In 1996, Robert Joseph Silveria Jr. was examined as a potential suspect in the murders. The cabin in which the murders occurred was demolished in 2004, unfortunately. In a 2008 documentary on the murders, Marilyn Smart claimed that she suspected her husband Martin and his friend John Boubide were responsible for the murders of Sue, John, Dana, and Tina. Marilyn claimed that on the evening of the crime, she had left Martin and Boubide at a local bar around 11 p.m. and returned home to go to sleep. Around 2 a.m. on April 12th, she stated that she awoke to find the two burning down an unknown item in the wood stove. Additionally, she alleged that Martin hated Johnny Sharp with a passion. However, in the documentary, the 2008 one, Sheriff Doug Thomas said he personally interviewed Martin and that Martin had passed a polygraph examination. Also, I just want to say, too, polygraph examinations are not fail-safe. They measure a lot of different things that are happening in your body, but they are not like a tried and true metric of if you're lying or not.
That's one, for me, that's just like one little piece.
Yeah, I trust blood spatterings.
Or just like what makes the most, you know, what's traditionally, is it it's a family member or mm-hmm. somebody that you known to them and not usually like a random drifter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's usually, again, it's not. And we've talked about cases where random people might have been involved and it's just like, oh my God, arbitrarily this thing, or even like in cold blood, you know, it was an arbitrary murder that became iconic, but that's most 99.9% of the time it is not that. So Martin Smart, we can't talk to because he died of cancer in Portland in June 2000. John Boubide, who allegedly had ties to organized crime in Chicago, died there in 1988. On March 24th, 2016, a hammer matching the description of the hammer Martin claimed to have lost was discovered in a local pond and taken into evidence by Plumas County Special Investigator Mike Gamberg. Plumas County Sheriff Hagwood, who was 16 years old at the time of the murders and knew the Sharp family personally, stated the location it was found, it would have been intentionally put there. It would have not been accidentally misplaced. Gamberg also stated that at the time, six potential suspects were being examined. In a 2016 article published by the Sacramento Bee detailing the discovery of the hammer shortly after the murders, Martin had left Keddie and driven to Reno, Nevada. From there, he sent a letter to Marilyn ruminating on personal struggles in their marriage, which he concluded with, "I've paid the price of your love, and now I've bought it with four people's lives." Uh-oh. In a 2016 interview, Gamberg stated that the letter was overlooked in the initial investigation and never admitted as evidence. He later criticized the quality of the initial investigation, saying, "You could take someone just coming out of an academy and they'll have done a better job." A counselor with whom Martin regularly visited would also allege that he had admitted to the murders of Sue and Tina, but claimed, "I didn't have anything to do with the boys." He allegedly told the counselor that Tina was killed to prevent her from identifying him, as she had witnessed the whole thing. Oof. So again, if that's the case, you're not wrong in that it was the person next door, essentially, with like a bad history and violent acts and kind of had to dispose of anyone who caught him doing these things. In April 2018, the Plumas County Sheriff's Office analyzed some DNA taken from a strip of white medical tape consistent with that used to bind the victim's hands and ankles and cover the mouth of one victim. County Sheriff's Office moves forward in its efforts to solve the murder case. We don't know. They haven't identified that yet. So they're like, we have found a match. Sheriff Gamberg says there are people locally who know more than they've said, and I believe we've identified some of them, and we know who they are, and they know who we are. And I have every confidence that either they participated after the fact or they have firsthand information. It's obviously a worthwhile pursuit. There's not an expiration date on homicides, and to the extent that we are surveying siblings and family members, it is our fundamental obligation to them to understand who did this and why. So that was a quote in 2016. This is still happening. So crazy that a sheriff who was personal friends with the family is now on the case, which feels very good and also very cinematic, I would say. But this case could be solved in a matter of like a year, maybe less. It is ongoing and we will keep you updated. I want to thank the Reno Gazette Journal, People Magazine, Plumas County News, and the Reno Gazette Journal again.
I feel so much like info it's, I just feel what I hear, like, if just imagine coming home, finding dead people dead, right? Yeah. Other people in the next room, and they're like, hey, what's going on? He's like, oh, we were just watching TV or taking a nap. What's going on? Well, I mean, there's people here that were like, they weren't like poisoned, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it was violent.
It was violent and loud, and they were just like, oh, no, I didn't.
But they could have taken them out. It was also like, again, to play devil's advocate, like later-ish for kids to be up. So they may have been like fast asleep and this all happened. But also like, why? You know, like we still don't really, we know why maybe one of them died later because she witnessed it. But we don't really know why this all happened. And what a horrible, like, can you imagine the guilt if the boys in the other room didn't do it? The guilt of them being the ones that didn't die in that cabin that night? Like, wow.
But I feel like in any other situation, if you watched a movie, TV show, listen to anything else, the first thing you'd be like, well, who was there? Like, oh, yeah, we were there. But
yeah, it's like, who's in the closest proximity?
I mean, the next thing would be like if the boys were just kind of sitting there next to them and be like, oh, yeah, they were murdered. I don't know who did it. That's the next. That would be the next move. You'd be like, well, that's odd. Mm-hmm. And not to say that it is the case because literally anything could happen at any time. But when you're like, oh no, it was a mafia LSD deal gone bad.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely like out there. But it feels like there's, in this case, too much information. Yeah. Where it's like, what about the car and that car and those two men and those two, you know, like, where all these like dudes floating around? And then,
but some of that's just people saying that.
True,
right?
But it's like, why were they, you know, like who's saying what and when? It's like you're trying to parse all of these different opinions and facts. And on top of it, horrible investigation, you know,
and that's where a lot of it boils down to is not prepared, not used to it. It's not like, oh, we have like
tiny little town,
tiny town, and again, you know, early 1980s. I don't know. There's just something about There's something about that time. And as soon as I hear that, I was like, this is not going to go well.
No, yeah, I think it's also interesting who heard muffled screams and who didn't too. I think that's very like. The neighbors didn't, but other neighbors did. So it's very like, okay.
You know, in fairness, sometimes have you ever heard something? You're like, what was that?
Yeah.
And it could have been like
anything.
Literally
anything.
It could be a coyote. It could be a murder. Or it could be people fighting. Mm-hmm. It could be somebody's radio. Like, you don't know. You don't know what it is. So when you're not used to hearing something, it's like jumping out and calling the police every time you hear a noise. You know,
yeah, especially you're in the woods. Like, this is a cabin. It's also just an eerie premise where you move to a different place and you live in, like, a cabin, like, motel area.
I don't want to, like, you know, generalize the people, but I feel like somebody didn't move from, like, a, you know, mini mansion in Danbury, Connecticut, and then move to, like a decrepit-ish cabin in Northern California. And not to say, because sometimes demographics and social and economic things can play into it. You know, poverty or being in a lower income
bracket, sure.
But also, obviously, rich people do things all the time, too.
Horrible
middle
things.
Class, everyone's horrible, doing horrible everything
things.
All the time.
Everyone's
but
killing. Everyone's fucking up. Everyone's yeah. fucking around. Yeah. All of you. No one is above fuckery.
Except January Jones.
No, that's true.
Yeah.